Good morning. I'd like to welcome you all to this morning's event on the future of peacekeeping and the role of the United Nations. We're delighted to have with us to discuss this topic a panel of stellar speakers. First, we welcome back Jean-Marc Coicco, a former USIP senior fellow from 2000 to 2001 and the author of the book we're launching today, Beyond the National Interest, the Future of UN Peacekeeping and Multilateralism in an Era of U.S. Primacy. This book is the culmination of Dr. Coicco's fellowship project on multilateralism and superpower, dilemmas of international democratic culture. And it is the latest in a series of USIP books that explore the role of the United Nations in a changing world. Other recent USIP publications include Michael Matheson's Council Unbound, The Growth of UN Decision-Making on Conflict and Post-Conflict Issues After the Cold War, Teresa Whitfield's Friends Indeed, The United Nations, Groups of Friends, and the Resolution of Conflict, and the Institute's congressionally mandated UN Task Force report, American Interests and UN Reform, and its update. We look forward to a lively discussion in the coming hours of some of the issues raised in these publications and in Jean-Marc's new book. We have prepared written bios for each of today's three speakers, but let me introduce them briefly. Our main speaker, Dr. Jean-Marc Coicco, is currently the head of the United Nations University Office at UN headquarters in New York. He served as senior academic officer in the Peace and Governance Program at the UN University in Tokyo. Before joining the UNU, he was speechwriter for UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali. A former fellow at Harvard University and New York University School of Law, Dr. Coicco has held appointments as cultural attaché with the French Ministry of Foreign Affairs, legislative aide with the European Parliament, associate professor at the University of Paris, and visiting professor at the École Normale Supérieure in Paris. He has written extensively on the subject of international law and is author of numerous books in French and English on authoritarian democracy in Latin America and on legitimacy and political power. His latest books in English include as co-author Power in Transition, The Peaceful Change of International Order, and as a co-editor, Ethics and International Affairs, Extent and Limits, The Legitimacy of International Organizations, and the Globalization of Human Rights. Dr. Coicco holds a PhD in political science and law from the Sorbonne and a doctorat d'etat from the Institut d'études politiques of Paris. Following Dr. Coicco's presentation, we'll hear from our two discussants, Ruth Wedgwood and Thomas Grant. Dr. Wedgwood is the Edward B. Burling Professor of International Law and Diplomacy and is Director of the International Law and Organizations Program at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Her areas of expertise include issues relating to constitutional law and U.S. foreign policy, the United Nations, diplomacy, human rights, and the rule of law. From a long and impressive CV, which I'm not going to detail, I would note that she's held many government and academic and legal posts, having served as the U.S. member of the UN Human Rights Committee and a member of the U.S. Secretary of State's Advisory Committee for International Law, Defense Policy Board, and CIA Historical Review Panel. She was the U.S. public delegate to the OSCE Warsaw Human Dimension Meeting and was an independent expert for the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. Dr. Wedgwood was formerly professor of law at Yale Law School, director of studies at the Hague Academy for International Law in the Netherlands, visiting professor at the University of Paris.
And Tom Grant was my student at UNC.
Et cetera. Et cetera, et cetera. She's a commentator for the BBC, NPR, PBS, and MSNBC, and she holds a JD from Yale University, where she was a professor of Tom Grant. Finally, we'll hear from Tom Grant, one of USIP's current senior fellows. Dr. Grant's project here investigates how states and international organizations have applied international law to address the conflict in Chechnya, and in turn what that conflict tells us about the limits and potential of international law in a world of still powerful sovereign states. Since 2002, Dr. Grant has taught international law at Cambridge University, where he's a fellow of the Wolfson College and the Lauterpacht Center for International Law. He's assisted on cases before the ICJ and before ad hoc international tribunals and has prepared legal advice on various public international law matters. His research interests and publications address legal questions related to failed states, the United Nations, U.S. foreign policy, and genocide. Dr. Grant has held a number of visiting fellowships at the Max Planck Institute for International Law in Heidelberg, Germany, and is a junior member of Atlantic Brück, the German-American liaison group. He holds a B.A. in European History from Harvard University, summa cum laude, a J.D. from Yale Law School, where, again, he studied with our other discussant, and a Ph.D. in Law from Cambridge University, where he was also a Fulbright scholar. I've asked Dr. Kwakko to lead off the program with an overview of some of the issues that he addresses in the book. Drs. Wedgwood and Grant will then comment, and finally we'll open discussion to the audience, and we have a microphone at the side. I will ask you after the presentations, if you want to line up in a queue, we'll begin taking questions and leading off the discussion. Before turning over the podium, I would finally ask that you please turn off your cell phones or any other electronic devices you have. We are recording today's event, and we'll have the recording available on our website, but the cell phones, if they're not turned off completely, will actually interfere with our miking and recording system. So rather than just putting them on vibrate, we'd really prefer if you could turn them off. Secondly, I'd like to recognize the efforts of USIP staff involved in putting together today's event, especially Kay Heckler at the USIP Press, Shira Loewinger and Aaron Bauer in the Jennings Randolph Program, and Kuimba Boston in the Office of Public Affairs. And finally, I would add our usual disclaimer that the remarks of the speakers do not necessarily reflect the position of the Institute, which does not take policy positions. And I will now turn it over to Dr. Kwakko.
Thanks a lot, Jeannie, and good morning. I think I'll speak for 15, 20 minutes, it's okay? And I'll make my remarks very, very informal and straightforward and simple. First of all, I would like to thank USIP for in fact making this book possible. I mean, if it hadn't been for a fellowship given by USIP, I wouldn't have been able to write the book, so I'm very grateful for the support and for the help. So maybe I will start with trying to indicate why I got interested in the topic and what I try to do in the book. I mean, as Jeannie mentioned, a long time ago, in fact 10 years ago, I served as a speechwriter for former UN Secretary General Boutros Ghali. My initial background was not at all in international relations or international law, so I was really learning on the job, so to speak. And as Jeannie mentioned, I was writing speeches in French, French and English being the two official languages of the UN. And one of the questions which really puzzled me during the time I was working for Boutros was precisely the extent and the limits of solidarity exercised beyond borders, and of course what was interesting for me was to realize that the sense of limitations was much more powerful than extending in a forceful manner a sense of solidarity. So I thought that perhaps it would be interesting for me as a way to educate myself and as a way to really map things out, it would be interesting to try to understand the reasons behind having this sense of solidarity beyond borders being so limited. And I thought that perhaps a good angle would be peacekeeping operations. And there were two simple reasons for this. First of all, even though it's not so much the case nowadays, at least in the 90s, peacekeeping operations were really the most visible set of activities of the UN, and they had been for a long time. And second of all, most of peacekeeping operations in the UN context don't really deal with major strategic issues. They don't really involve the national interests of countries, and therefore they are much more about exercising a sense of solidarity beyond borders than about projecting a sense of national interest. So I thought that as a way to try to think about solidarity at the international level, as a way to think about the limits of solidarity beyond borders, I thought that trying to understand peacekeeping operations within this framework would be a good exercise. And of course, in the course of the book, I realized that what was really going to be the focus was less the extent of solidarity and really the limitations of solidarity. And so I tried to look for explanations for these limitations. And first of all, as a way to really make the case for the fact that the sense of solidarity is very, very limited, I really, and that's the content of the first chapter, I tried to assess the peacekeeping operations which took place since the early 90s. And if you have a chance to read the book, you will see that out of all the peacekeeping operations which took place in the 90s, in fact, I review all of them, I came to conclude that very few of them can be really assessed in successful terms. Most of the peacekeeping operations launched in the since the early 90s are either obvious failures or at best, mix an in-between failure and success. And therefore, you know, once I had done this evaluation, the rationale for me was, okay, what are the reasons explaining these limitations of solidarity at the international level as assessed through peacekeeping operations? And in the book, I focus on three possible explanations. One has to do with the UN. One has to do with the structure of international life, that is to say the interface between international law and the national bent of international life. And the third one has to do with the ambiguous role of major democratic powers, and that is to say the US, the UK and France, which really have been playing a leading role within the Security Council regarding exercising a sense of solidarity at the international level. So if you don't mind, I'll review quickly these three these three reasons as a way to really try to account for the limitations of solidarity through the angle of peacekeeping operations. So the second chapter is about really trying to understand within the UN context how an international bureaucracy such as the one of the UN accounts for the limitations of solidarity at the international level. And of course here the focus is human rights. I mean, throughout the book, the benchmark of solidarity is the defense of human rights. And when I talk about the limitations of the UN when it comes to exercising this sense of solidarity at the international level, I tend to focus on two dimensions, the institutional dimension and the political dimension. When it comes to the institutional dimension, my argument comes down to the fact that even though the UN tends to be described as a huge bureaucracy, if the UN is a bureaucracy, I think that it has nothing to do with the fact that it would have huge resources, being human resources, financial resources, political resources, military resources. In fact, I would argue, and this is based on the figures that I really discovered, I mean, the UN is, in connection with its global goals, is in a way short of resources. I'll give you an example. In the 90s, in the Department of Peacekeeping Operations, which is meant to somehow bridge the field and UN headquarters, overviewing the work of the UN, and I think that at the time you had more than 70,000 people deployed in the Balkans, you had less than 5 people monitoring the work of these people in the Department of Political Affairs. 5 people didn't make sense. The same would apply for the PKO. So just for me to say that really the resources in the 90s at the height of peacekeeping operations dedicated to monitoring from New York the field were really not up to the task. And you could make the argument also when it comes to budget. I think that the overall budget of DPKO spending between the early 90s and 2000 was for 10 years or so $20 billion. And of course $20 billion seems to be quite a bit of money, but in fact when you compare the spending with the one of major countries in terms of military spending on a yearly basis, you realize that it's nothing. I think that throughout the 90s, that's the number that I mentioned in my book, the U.S. on a regular basis spent in its for its military spending more than $250 billion a year. And of course, the U.S. is the first military spender when it comes to defense and so on. The second military spender was Japan, which was spending on a yearly basis throughout the 90s around $40 billion. The fourth one was the UK spending close to $40 billion, and the third one was the UK, the fourth one was France spending between $35 and $40 billion a year. So $20 billion for 10 years for the exercise of solidarity beyond borders within the context of peacekeeping operations and to a very large extent dedicated to defense of human rights. So $20 billion for 10 years, and then the figures that I just mentioned for each of these four countries, which are the primary spenders when it comes to national defense. So just for me to stress the fact that really the resources are not there. And even though things have improved drastically since the early 2000s, partly following a number of reports which made the point that precisely the disconnect between the global mandates and the resources at hand were not sustainable, things have improved, but yet I don't think that we are in a much, much, much better position. In fact, in the past years, the current Undersecretary General of Peacekeeping Operations, Mr. Guéhenno, has repeatedly argued that, in fact, even though things have improved, there is still a disconnect or discrepancy or a gap between the needs and the resources at hand. The second problem when it comes to the UN is of a political nature. And I illustrate this, and it comes down to weak political leadership. And I illustrate this point in the book by analyzing the relationship between the Secretary General and the Security Council. Of course, when you think about the relationship between the SG and the Security Council, even though the SG has a prominent moral position, power resides with the Security Council. And even when the relationships between, or the relationship between the SG and the Security Council is a good one, in fact, tensions always arise. Tensions which in the end undermine, if not cripple, the ability of political leadership to be exercised in a forceful manner in a UN setting. And in fact, when you are dealing with crises which are very, very difficult to address and to solve, while we would need forceful political leadership, the fact that the tensions are at the very core of its relationship always really weakens this ability that the UN has to really convey forceful political leadership. So just these two points as a way to really exercise that structurally, I don't think that the UN is in a good position to really deliver what it is supposed to deliver in terms of projecting the sense of solidarity within the context of peacekeeping operations. The second element that I look into in the book is the structure of international life. And here I try to analyze the relationship between international norms, the norms of international law, and the structure of international life. And as a way to try to understand whether or not these norms have an impact on the reluctance of the international community to get involved within countries in the name of human rights. And I don't want to be too technical here, and in any case, I'm not an international lawyer, so I would probably make mistakes, but one thing that I focus on in this chapter is the interesting relationship existing among the norms of international law, the norms which are the core of the law of war and peace. When you think, and Ruth will probably correct me on this matter, when you think about the core norms of the law of war and peace, I mean, you can think about seven really principles or norms: good faith, cooperation, respect for human rights, self-determination, national sovereignty, commitment to peaceful handling of tensions, and the seventh one, I don't recall what it is actually at the moment. But the point is that among these norms, you have, and that's the interesting thing. You have at the same time relationships of compatibility and relationships of competition. Compatibility is, of course, very much required. Otherwise, these norms wouldn't amount to a system of international law. Obviously, between, for instance, self-determination and human rights, you have a sense of compatibility. Between cooperation, commitment to cooperation, and good faith, and pacific settlement of disputes, you have clearly a sense of compatibility. The problem arises when, in fact, among these norms, which are really the guidelines for the management of international life, the problem arises when you have a sense of competition. And throughout the 90s, and this continues to this day, in fact, among key norms, within this list of norms, you had a very strong sense of competition between, for instance, defense of human rights and national sovereignty. The point being that in the 90s, and it is still the case today, commitment to a territorial understanding of national sovereignty, that is to say, you know, within my borders, I am the master and that's it, and respect for human rights, you had a tension. And in the handling of the humanitarian crisis, which was at the core of multilateral politics in the 90s, member states, that is to say primarily the permanent members of the council, that is to say the US, France, and the UK, had somehow to handle this tension and decide which way it would go. And very often, they tended to take the middle ground between pushing too far, between refusing to push too far imperatives associated with human rights and imperatives associated with national sovereignty understood in a territorial manner. And in fact, this competition among key norms of international law, guiding once again the way member states tend to think about what would be the right way to address this crisis, really, I think, was at the very center of the dilemmas encountered by the members of the Security Council throughout the 90s, and I think that these dilemmas are very much still at work today. This leads me to my third explanation, having to do with the ambiguous role of key democratic countries. Throughout the 90s, and it is still very much the case, in fact, you have three countries really leading the pack within the Security Council, taking really the lead and taking responsibility for things which would be done. The US, of course, the UK, and France, China, and Russia, taking more or less the back seat, and of course the contribution of these three Western countries when it comes to multilateralism, when it comes to human norms of human rights, when it comes to really trying to have a sense of solidarity beyond borders being conceptualized and implemented, these three countries have played a pivotal role. And in fact, also since the 90s, they have been contributing tremendously in terms of making sure that the international community would do something about the crisis in the Balkans, in Africa, and so on. So historically, as well as in contemporary terms, both when it comes to norms, when it comes to political support, when it comes to military support, when it comes to financial support, these three countries really have been the underwriters of the international system, of multilateralism, as well as the progressive things which have been done in terms of human rights since the early 90s. So the good news is that these democratic Western nations, among with other Western nations, have a positive role in terms of underwriting the system and its progressive aspects. The bad news is that while being the underwriters of the system, they also tend to be the underminers of the system. And that's what I argue about in the book, in the sense that they have a very strange, or they tend to have, and of course the more powerful you are, the more the tendency exists to go along this direction, these powerful Western countries, although committed to progressive and democratic values, tend to have a very strange or self-serving understanding what is the dynamic of rights and reciprocities. I mean, these countries tend to think that they have all the rights they want and hardly any duties, while others have many duties and very few rights. So there is a bit of an imbalance in the handling of the reciprocity of rights and duties, which makes these countries, at the same time, the underwriters and the underminers of the international system and of the multilateral system. And of course, it's a problem because in the end, it generates all kinds of difficulties in terms of the legitimacy of the international system, the legitimacy of international law, the legitimacy of the UN, and the legitimacy of the policies conducted in the name of the international system, international law, the UN, and so on and so on. So I talk about it in the book, and I all the more talk about these things, considering that I dedicate two chapters to U.S. foreign policy. I have one chapter focusing on Clinton's foreign policy and one on Bush foreign policy. And of course, one could wonder what was the need to really focus or to have a full chapter on Bush foreign policy, keeping in mind that, in fact, the Bush administration had no interest whatsoever in peacekeeping operations, very little interest in the UN, and therefore that somehow the topic on which I was focusing was totally being irrelevant in the 2000s. And this is partly true. Yet, on the other hand, if you compare the 90s and the 2000s, and that's why the book is still, I think, relevant, you have a number of issues which were at the very center of multilateral politics in the 90s, which remain at the center of multilateral politics in the 2000s. I mean, the 90s were, and I'll give you the list of this, if I recall them, the list of this, of these themes, which are like a common thread between the 90s and the 2000s. At the very center of the 90s, we had the use of force. Why should we use force and how we should use force? Well, even though the context is very different, you still have this question at the very center of international politics and of multilateral politics in the 2000s. So that's one common theme, even though the context and the answers given to the question is very different. Another theme which is also very important both for the 90s and the 2000s is the importance of the Atlantic Alliance. I mean, if it hadn't been for the Atlantic Alliance in the 90s, nothing would have been done in the Balkans and so on. Of course, this Atlantic Alliance had all kinds of problems, yet it was pivotal. Well, in the 2000s, if you recall what happened in the context of the war against Iraq, I mean, clearly this alliance was very, very important, even though it almost broke down. It was one of the central issues of the war against Iraq. So that's the second theme. And you can really list a number of themes which the 90s and the 2000s share, even though, once again, the context is different, and even though the answers given to these questions or these common themes are different. So then it leads me, and I just don't want to spend too much time, it leads me to a number of perhaps suggestions on how to try to solve the problems that I pinpoint in the book, including how to try to make peacekeeping more relevant and international solidarity more of a reality. And what I argue in the book is that we have to really think about finding ways to really dovetail better than it is the case so far, power and legitimacy on the one hand, and solidarity and security on the other hand. One of the problems that we have nowadays, both when it comes to U.S. foreign policy as well as what, as well as when it comes to the international order, we have a disconnect between power and legitimacy. For instance, the UN is viewed as by certain people as legitimate and yet has hardly any power. At the moment, U.S. foreign policy has problem with legitimacy as exercise power, but as problems of legitimacy. Same thing for the disconnect between solidarity and security. In the end, I tend to think, and that's one of the messages that you can take away from the notion of rule of law, the best way to secure security is to dovetail security and solidarity. And while this is true at the national level, this is even truer at the global level. So somehow I think to really solve the problems or the predicament in which we find ourselves nowadays, we have to dovetail better than we have been able to do in the past, power and legitimacy on the one hand, and solidarity and security on the other hand. So when it comes to how this could happen in the U.S. foreign policy context, I come up with a number of suggestions as a way to try to have foreign policy in the U.S. context contributing to this need for better dovetailing of power and legitimacy and solidarity and security. And my suggestions, if I find them, have to do, first of all, with finding a better balance between the national interest and the international interest within the context of U.S. foreign, within the context of U.S. foreign policy. I mean, perhaps it will seem a bit radical to you, but really, from an outsider's point of view, you really have the feeling that the U.S. Tends to see only one national interest legitimate, the U.S. one. Any other national interest is not fully seen as legitimate. At least that's the perception that you have beyond the U.S. So finding a better balance between the national interest and the international interest is, I think, something which would be needed as a way to make U.S. foreign policy more inclusive. The second thing that I would recommend to think about is to really be fully aware of the democratic constraints when it comes to of the constraints of democratic values when it comes to U.S. foreign policy. I don't think that U.S. policymakers, when it comes to foreign policy, have factored in to the extent which would be needed the need to really take into account and what it means in terms of methodology and in terms of policies, democratic values. So that would be, and I develop this idea in the book, so that would be my second suggestions. Another thing that I address in the book is the issue of what I call global provincialism. I mean, in a way, the U.S. Is very much a global power, and yet tends to be undermined by, at the same time, a provincial view of the world. And I think, traveling quite a bit, around the world, I see it every day. I think that this combination of provincialism and globalism is detrimental to U.S. foreign policy, as well as to the ability of U.S. foreign policy to undermine international order. So these are just three examples in terms of suggestions which perhaps could help making U.S. foreign policy more legitimate abroad, but also which perhaps could help having the U.S. contribution to a more legitimate international order, and therefore which could help also to have the exercise of solidarity at the international order at the international level being perhaps more efficient. And I think I'll stop here, and I'll apologize for my French accent and my grammar, which is not perfect. Thank you.
We'll start. start off the discussions with Ruth Wedgwood.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here with my former student, Thomas Grant, who's grown up just fine, and with Jean-Marc Clicquot, who indeed worked for Bucho Scali, who was a very elegant man and I think underappreciated. He had faults, but he had great virtues, too, so I envy you that experience. And one has to say, too, that USIP, even if you're going to move way to the mall, where I can never visit you anymore, nonetheless has so far established a brilliant track record in writing about UN problems and peacekeeping. And other than Lester Pearson Institute in Canada, which does practical training, this place has become the it place to go for thoughtful case studies of what's gone wrong and right in peacekeeping operations. And at a time when the UN itself really had no lessons learned capacity or unit, this became the place that really was giving some sense of chagrin and triumph in past operations. So I think just looking backward to the Gingrich-Mitchell report and then Mike Matheson's book on Security Council law and practice and Jean-Marc Clicquot's book, it's a very worthy tradition to maintain. And as we all know, peacekeeping really was pride of place for the UN. It was Ralph Bunche's and Lester Pearson's invention, Chapter 6.5, the mythological legal authorization for its usage, early missions after the 1948 war in Palestine, Kashmir, Cyprus, going into first-generation peacekeeping, so-called, with the classical model that you would only do peacekeeping if your name was Mick Goulding, when there was consent of the parties, neutrality of the peacekeepers, and minimal use of force. It was kind of a Quaker bearing witness in military uniform. First thing, do no harm. But even if you look back, Congo itself was not first generation. That was confused second generation, not clear what the strategic mission was. Was it to prevent Katanga from seceding, or was it to keep the Soviets out? There was never quite any clarity on what even Congo was about. But the ideal Weberian type, second generation, complicated service delivery, refugees, post-conflict reconstruction, purporting and trying to do a lot more than simply being an interpositional truce-watching force. I will make a third generation, I'm afraid. It's the lost generation. It's Hemingway in Paris. It's the Spanish Civil War generation. It's the disappointed, désolé, generation of peacekeeping, which really certainly is very much with us. I go to Pally Wilson in Geneva all the time, and there's a statue of Sergio out front. And it's the generation of UN people who realized that they are a player. They may think they are supernumeraries who float in the heaven of multilateralism, but to people on the ground, they are just another player. And therefore, they're subject to the same kinds of critics of attacks and upon legitimacy and efficacy that other people on the ground are. So the idea that a blue-helmeted, blue-beret person would be chosen for attack, that an NGO person or a ICRC person would be chosen for attack, was, I think, quite startling, shocking to people. I mean, it's foreseen in a way in Congo. Ralph Brian Urquhart has that wonderful line in his Life in Peace and War, which he describes the locomotive going to Katanga and is met by a question from a local person saying, "Quelle tribu sont les Nations Unies?" What tribe are you from in the United Nations? The answer is we don't know. But I do think that the disillusion that people have felt first in the incapacity of the UN in Rwanda and in Bosnia, and second in the really startling idea that one could actually be a target, is something that's been very difficult for the institution to take on board. I love the French. I love solidarity. Vive la France, la révolution. Even the word solidarity is very French. 1968, Danny the Red. there's not much of it in the UN community, I'm afraid. This is why I've become a loving chicken hawk. Or as my friend from the UN Information Center down here chided me, he said, "I hope, Ruth, you're still half in love with us." Mm-hmm. And it's a complicated love, but at least 50%. But the problem often is that the purport of intervention by the United Nations is taken to be the solution of the problem, excusing every other nation from every nation from undertaking responsible action itself. And Les Gelb used to put this as the phenomenon that people would dump on the UN their most difficult problems as an alternative to having to formulate a national policy. But I do think it's almost pathological that, and the UN's complicit in it, I fear, from time to time. One doesn't want to say, oh, we can't do anything. There's this, always this process-oriented purport, I won't say pretense, but I might say pretense, that something's happening because we're talking about it. It's also the professional deformation of academics and lawyers and diplomats, that if you're talking about it, you're solving it, with very little sense that at times there are moments of serendipity, unhappy serendipity, when if you act, you can prevent a great harm, and if you don't, it gets much worse. I mean, if we had intervened in Bosnia, say, in 1993, whatever difficulties the Vance Owen plan had, nonetheless, you'd have less, 2 years less of war and a little more chance that Bosnia would not have been ripped apart with the ferocity that still lingers on today, where 10 years later there still is the widely held view that if we were to withdraw, if European troops were to withdraw, the place could go up in tinder again. So I do think that the UN has wittingly, I'll be harsh, forgive me, pas personnel, but there's a kind of apologetics, an elegant Trollopian apologetics that the UN too often perfects because of normal human embarrassment, that they're doing something when nothing is being done, and that excuses and lets off the hook every other state. I first came down to Washington, actually, I was telling Tom, how I got to Johns Hopkins. I went to see, in the late 90s, Elliot Cohen to ask, where should we put a gendarmerie in the U.S. military if we were interested in robust nation-building policing? And he told me the Marines do it, the reserve, the rear area security functions of the Marines. But that's how I got here, actually, wondering how the U.S. could become more interested in peacekeeping. And now in Iraq, if you will, we are. No one else is there, of course, to speak of, or is beset by parliaments that would have them withdraw. But what the UN has come to grips with, as the US also has now, is it's very, very difficult to do the kind of micro-policing that you need to keep security in a war-torn environment where there are no clear battle lines. The IEBL, the inter-entity boundary line that Holbrooke invented for Bosnia, was a kind of like a vulgar analogy, but a mastectomy. Just cut it in half and keep them each other in opposite corners. But the actual micro-policing that you need for any return to normalcy is not something that anybody is very willing to proffer because it's risky. You have guys who are on their own in small little police cabins in forward areas. It's actually more of the Petraeus strategy now in Iraq. Don't stay behind your barbed wire. Get out there and get to know folks, get to know the political and clan structure of particular towns, but it's risky, and countries don't like to have casualties. Democratic, non-democratic countries don't like the casualties that go with intensive policing, which is the new form of necessary peacekeeping. On the UN itself, some things have gotten better, some things have gotten worse. There's some dandy new people in PKO. David Harland, a brilliant New Zealand dip, is working on a lessons learned unit, which is a new thing. Jane Hall Lute, married to Doug Lute of the Iraq Czar in the White House, is doing mission support, and she's a very capable ex-Army officer. There's better planning in advance of missions. But some things never go away. Great power politics and the Security Council never go away. The paralysis on Rwanda, France versus Anglophonic India, Africa, was paralyzing. The problem of countries being beholden by energy politics, if China is involved in Sudan and Iran, doesn't go away. And you can't be a good multilateral player just by sibilantly quoting the S word of solidarity. You have to be a Machiavellian, virtuous politician to know how you can put together a coalition of the politically willing, or at least the acquiescent, in the UN. I think two of the wonderful things that happened lately, I love and salute the coinage that was put forward by Gareth Evans of responsibility to protect, to say that left and right is not any longer a suitable schism, that if you are a serious human rights person, that you have a duty to think through what you need to have by way of infrastructure, military forces, to protect people on the ground. You can't do every crisis, but the premise that passivity is moral is one that I think has died a hard death in the course of the disappointments of UN peacekeeping in the last decade. So responsibility to protect, I think, is an interesting translation for people who are involved in human rights, that it's not sufficient simply to be part of the talk shop, but that ultimately there is a responsibility to interpose yourself in a way that is effective. Additionally, I think there's perhaps somewhat more understanding that to be good in peacekeeping, you have to know the politics on the ground. I'll just give you one example, which was put forward to me, that of a difficulty in Sudan that I had been unaware of, that in the course of thinking through how you would protect the rebels and or not the rebels, but the civilians in Darfur from the Janjaweed, that in fact, I can't verify this, it's just a report by a diplomat from Africa, that the justice and equality movement is in fact a movement, one of the rebel movements, around which al-Turabi, who was a major figure in the radical Islamist regime in Sudan from 89 to 99, is hovering. And God forbid that the protection of civilians in Darfur should become the pretext by which, in fact, one has a return to power of a highly destructive radical regime in Khartoum. So I think there's some more sense of that, but even in the UN, people who serve in the Department of Political Affairs rarely have done turns in the regions. They come in at 32, they leave at 62, and they are, in the French sense, fonctionnaires. They don't have the local grounded knowledge that you get by rotating through regions, and that has not really been solved. You also discover that most changes you want to make are ultimately in the hands of the General Assembly. We've never solved the problem of bloc politics in the General Assembly. We've never figured out how to break up some of the inhibitions that the G77 has about control of personnel and budget, and therefore there are really a set of, I won't call them Lilliputians, they're macroputian constraints on what you can do in reforming peacekeeping as you would wish. Even somebody so eloquent as Lakhdar Brahimi, with his wonderful report on capacity building, could not get the General Assembly to adopt most of his reforms. And until you figure out how to fix General Assembly politics, you can't fix peacekeeping. But ultimately, since we're talking great power politics here, and I'll sit down, it really is, I think, up to either existing significant powers or those who would wish to be to understand that the pacifism that is Europe's fate, at least was Europe's fate in the immediate Cold post-World War II period, when the peace pact among European powers was seen to make military investment rather redundant and if not frightening, that this does not do for any ability to provide protective services globally. That if you don't invest more than 1 or 2% of your GDP in military infrastructure, then you can't bring forces to Sudan effectively. You can't do power projection. You can't do logistics. You will be dependent upon the Americans to provide the lift and to get to East Timor. And hyperpuissance was not the invention of the U.S. It was the invention of Europe by its unwillingness to, I think, rise to the task of resuming a kind of responsible global power. I used to joke that it was one of the reasons I was in favor of NATO expansion, because some of the countries that had recently been liberated from Soviets had a much more fervent sense of how delicate it was to maintain a sense of freedom. And finally, sense of what's missing in as a monitor of UN politics is the press. Now, there's very little serious reporting in New York. It's usually from 55,000 feet. I'll give you one example. I forgot my paper, so forgive me to pick this up here. It's something that I would have thought would be a major news item. It was something I tried to be helpful on unsuccessfully. Who should command the troops in Darfur to pick a responsible commander who would be very careful of the well-being of civilians on the ground? One of the names put forward was as deputy commander of the peacekeeping force was a Rwandan military man. I'm very conscious of the British libel law, so this is not for posting in Britain. And if you're British, you may not listen to this. But but there was some concern among people I knew in the New York community that he had been on the ground in Rwanda, in the northeast and the northwest, in 1994, in a period within the compass of the Rwanda Tribunal, in places where serious numbers of civilian casualties were noticed, shall we say, with an ongoing Spanish criminal inquiry into his activities. Three major instances where widespread killing of civilians occurred in his AOR while he was head of military intelligence for Rwanda. Now, if I was hiring somebody, I would find that troubling. It may be he's a victim of huge injustice, and I don't mean to propound any injustice by mentioning it here with specifics. But when these concerns were brought to the attention of people in PKO, the ultimate answer from the UN was, quote, it did not want to exclude the candidate on the basis of unsubstantiated allegations, unquote. Well, having lived through Darfur, having lived through Abu Ghraib, you should be concerned who's commanding your troops for control in a chaotic environment where it's all too easy to have things happen in the bush and have nobody bear witness. So that kind of reluctance to share bad information with the children and the reluctance to offend anybody who's a major player within UN politics is the subterranean events that prevent the UN from performing the way it should. And until you decrypt, I'll sit down here, but until you have reporters who are willing to decrypt their politics with the best of intentions. This is tough love, but necessary love. Because if there's a slaughter of civilians in Darfur by UN peacekeepers, God forbid, this would be another black eye. So you have to be willing to do the ground level, nitty-gritty politics, the kind we do in Washington every day. And I'm sure in Quai d'Orsay gets dissected nowadays a bit more than it used to be. But this kind of coverage of the subterranean conversations at the UN doesn't exist. And it's utterly crucial to reform the institution. Thanks.
Thank you, Ruth. We'll turn now to Tom Grant.
Thank you, Jeanine. Thank you, Ruth. And thank you, Jean-Marc, for joining us and presenting this book for our consideration. It's a wide-ranging book, and I think one of its obvious merits is that it gives us a tour d'horizon of a period of time when there were so many new peacekeeping operations. In that sense, it's especially the early chapters are a sort of reference that I think people are going to find useful when looking for some inside details about how these operations take place. I mentioned to Jean-Marc earlier, just before our session, that at our center in Cambridge, a gentleman called Sam Dawes spent some months writing a book about the procedures of the UN Security Council. His interest wasn't the, frankly, more interesting high politics behind the UN, but like our author today, he had spent time on the scene in the UN, and that made his output really particularly useful because there's so much that you can learn by reading cases and reading a documentary output, but that only goes so far. To have someone who's been in the Secretariat present a perspective on events is really valuable, and that's something that I think this book is going to stand out for. Another thing is that it gives a view onto the interplay amongst the internal politics of the Secretariat, the politics of the five powers, the five permanent members of the Security Council, and it tells us also how the politics of Washington, D.C., of the United States, play a role in decision-making at UN level. And that's something, especially the U.S. dimension, is something that is really valuable for people to have a better view on when one of the former vice chancellors of Cambridge University, Sir David Williams, who's an eminent constitutional lawyer, a UK constitutional lawyer, but somebody who knows the US very well, he once lamented to me that Europeans don't pay enough attention to the processes in Washington that decide the course of American policy. Everyone seems to know in Europe that the United States is very important, the most important power. The subtitle of the book refers to an era of U.S. primacy. Yet, when it comes to even rudimentary understanding of how things work in the U.S. political process, that's lacking on the other side of the ocean, unless you go to the very specialized sections of their foreign ministries and academia. But in the wider policy community, they should read the chapter about congressional appropriations, or the chapter in which Jean-Marc talks about congressional appropriations and the relation between defense appropriations and UN budgeting, peacekeeping budgeting. I think that's useful material, very informative. A recurring theme in the book, and it comes out in our discussion today, Ruth touched on a number of points that touch on this theme, is responsibility. The responsibility to protect is the most recent iteration of a line of discussion which has had the aim of putting flesh on the bones of an international responsibility to take action when certain sorts of problems arise. Now, as international lawyers, we are struck by the slowness, the great length of time that it often takes for what seem to be very basic propositions to take root. If you look at an international organization, well, we've had these entities like, not quite like the UN, but we've had international organizations since the mid 19th century. By the early 20th century, one would have thought that states who were increasingly interested in using such organs to perform certain transnational functions, you would have thought that they would have gotten their hands around the idea that if you have, such authority in such a body, there must be some commensurate responsibility for its actions. But it's only the late 1940s, 4 years into the UN system, but really over a half a century into a period where international organizations existed and played a role in certain functional areas. Only at that point did the International Court come to the view that the UN is an international legal person which could oppose rules and make claims against others in the reparation case. And it's only in 1999 that the flip side of responsibility was touched on, really not dealt with decisively, but touched upon in the Kumaraswamy advisory opinion, where hints were given that other entities or states could oppose rules against the UN. In other words, if you are capable of acting as an international legal person and making a claim against someone, then there must be a symmetry there, and others must be able to make claims against you if you've transgressed. But it's taken a long time for both sides of the responsibility equation to acquire even the very bare bones of a legal substantiation. It's remarkable how long those very basic propositions took to take root. Now, one thing that comes out in our discussion today is that there is a need to build on that. The Brahimi report is mentioned. There was an unprecedented degree of soul searching with respect to the disaster at Srebrenica. There have been reports and discussions about the default of international power in Rwanda. None of this goes so far as to say that an international organization, or the UN in particular, is responsible for its mistakes or its failure to take action when action might have been taken. But it's pointing in a direction. It's pointing toward a future position where an international organization might well have to account for both its conduct and its inaction when circumstances merited more vigorous response. There are a number of points that struck me in reading the book. And the insider's account of the negotiations that went on behind establishing UNASCOM in Somalia struck me as really interesting. We hear a lot in diplomatic discussions about purposive ambiguity, the need sometimes not to be too clear about what we're doing, because if we're too clear, the various parties whom we wish to engage in a project might not engage. In other words, if you give everybody a little bit of leeway of interpretation, a margin of appreciation, you get more people on board. It's a basic concept. You see it in treaty making. You see it in creating coalitions to carry out particular tasks. It's a very useful mechanism. But the problem with purposive ambiguity is that though it may have utility in getting people into the room to participate, it can also obscure the reasons for which you want them in the room in the first place. I thought that came out very clearly when Jean-Marc described the really difficult pirouettes that were done to put together this operation in Somalia. We put it together, countries participated, and then there was near paralysis when it came.
And it happens all the time.
And it happens all too often. Yeah, and there's near paralysis. Right. You couldn't actually. Command and control didn't work. The chain of command was unclear. Those may have been necessary predicates to having any operation, but then these necessary predicates paradoxically contained the seeds for the breakdown of the operation when finally it got underway. And that seems to me to be almost a tragic aspect of these operations. Ruth alluded to the role of the media, and the role of the media is discussed in the book. One of the things that occurs to me when reading the book is that if you are involved in a media organization, there is a tendency to find safe harbors. And large organizations, whether your own foreign ministry or the UN Secretariat, are a safe harbor in the sense that if you take your information from them and don't look beyond the information they give you, if it proves to be wrong, at least you can say, we got it from an authoritative source. We didn't get it from a junior reporter in the field. If a junior reporter in the field tells you that such and such a nominee for an important UN post has a cloud over his head because people here in the field say, there might be something wrong, but then the UN Secretariat or your own foreign ministry says, don't worry, this candidate is quite all right, you're a lot safer politically just going with the authoritative source, because even if they're wrong, you can say, look, they told us. We weren't relying on the dubious authority of our own reporters. That seems to be a structural problem with the media, and maybe really with lots of organizations, not just media organizations. I was struck by the historical paradox that the 19th century equivalent of the Permanent Five, the Concert of Europe, if you will, and I don't want to overdraw the analogies between the Concert of Europe and the Permanent Five members of the Security Council, but they do suggest themselves. The Concert was only too keen and too ready to get engaged in the Balkans, and especially in Africa. And how did they get engaged? And how they got engaged? They injected themselves into local politics to a very great extent. In one sense, there seems to be a great discontinuity in that today's major powers have been much more hesitant to involve themselves, especially in Africa. And the book is quite clear about the gap between responses in Europe and responses in Africa. Even with its failures, even with the deficit of response in Bosnia, the lateness of response in Bosnia, and some of the shortfalls in Kosovo, the response was a lot more vigorous, and that can actually be measured in dollars and cents and numbers of boots on the ground. By the same token, there's this fascinating historical continuity. Continuity is that in the 19th century, the arguments for that sort of engagement, especially in Africa, were very much hybrid arguments concerning both national security, the national interest of the day, or questions of commercial primacy or strategic position, on the one hand, and on the other hand, what they then called the mission civilatrice. We wouldn't call it that today. It had, there are all sorts of reasons why we wouldn't talk about that today, call it in those terms today. But in talking about creating solidarity and an international order based on human rights and respect for human dignity, I think there's some sort of genetic linkage back to the arguments that were adduced to support a more active engagement in various parts of the world in the 19th century. And the continuity that's very interesting is this hybridization of national interest justifications on the one hand and solidarity justifications on the other hand. In fact, it seems to me that's the big project behind the book. How can you get state actors, especially in the United States, to find a functional combination between those things, a combination that actually works? The book talks about a contrast between American decisiveness and American reluctance to do things. On the one hand, there are times when the U.S. acts very vigorously. At other times, some of our partners wish we would have acted more. But through that discussion, the book is very mindful of the question of capacity. And Ruth alluded to this. The question of capacity comes up again and again. The United States has a much larger commitment to defense and security than any of its partners. On the one hand, some of our partners decry that. There are concerns about social justice, questions about whether we should allocate that much money to defense. But on the other hand, we are asked to do more and more. I wonder whether a question that the book does not directly address, but I think unavoidably raises, needs more attention. And I think Ruth would agree it needs more attention. And that's the question, why are the European partners so far behind in this area of activity that they are very good advocates for? They're very articulate when it comes to putting forward the case for peacekeeping, peacebuilding, putting forward cadres who can help with institution building, but they haven't really done that much when it comes down to dollars and cents or euros and cents to expand their capacity. It seems to me this contrast between America's sometimes decisiveness and sometimes reluctance is superseded by this question of the gap in capacity. If the Europeans or other players had more capacity, then the options certainly would be more extensive. I wonder also, at one point, John Mark says that, quote, America was due to meet the international world of multilateral expectations and obligations that it had created for itself and other countries more than 40 years earlier. This is a reference to the UN system and the human rights treaties that came out of that system, and it's a reference as well to the shortfall between the aspirations of that human rights system and actual conduct by the United States during the Cold War. What I think you could talk about a little more, and I think it's useful to discuss, is why was there a shortfall during the Cold War? My own sense is that because there was a war. It may have been a war fought by unusual means. It wasn't a traditional war, but there was a sense of national emergency that lasted from the point where we realized that the Soviet Union was not going to conduct itself quite as a normal Western European power, and the time when the Soviet Union ended. During that time, it was indeed difficult to pursue the human rights and humanitarian agenda with the vigor we wanted. Now, that's not just an historical question. I think it's a question with really vital present-day implications. It has vital present-day implications because one has to answer the question, I think, when looking at high-level politics, international politics, geopolitics, if you will allow the phrase, you have to answer the question whether there's a war going on now. And a substantial part of official opinion in the United States is that we are, in fact, at war. And if you do not answer that, if you do not take that as a prior question, I'm not sure how much sense you can make of how we react to the need for greater solidarity on human rights and humanitarian law. That's not to say that being at war is an excuse to put aside fundamental norms. That's not the point. The point, how is instead, how do you operationalize those norms in a time of peace as distinguished from a time of war? It seems to me that that prior question does have to be answered before you can come to a solid conclusion about where we stand with an international solidarity aiming to entrench human rights and humanitarian law. I had an extraordinary meeting with a German international lawyer just some months ago, who had been a veteran of the Second World War, and the discussion was about recent Israeli intervention in Lebanon, and people around the table were concerned about humanitarian law and the application of humanitarian law in the recent operations in Lebanon. And what he said was, and this is a very elderly gentleman, he said that it's very hard, he didn't say it was hard, he said it's actually impossible to carry out operations in an environment where there is some segment of the civilian population dedicated to resistance if you wish to adhere to humanitarian rules. The humanitarian rules will not survive a counterinsurgency where there is some support for the insurgency amongst the civilians. And then he said, I know I was involved in a counterinsurgency, and he was referring to the Eastern Front in 42, 43, 44. And it was one of those moments, you know, people, the person was an impeccable humanitarian, but it really made people stop for a moment. How can, you know, because warfare is a really, really serious challenge to humanitarian law. Of course, I mean, obviously he was on the side of he was fighting on the side of the conflict that as a matter of policy could have cared less about humanitarian rules. But the point stood. Because there were people even on that side, people like Stauffenberg, who were actually concerned about these things, but it was awfully hard to make those concerns, to project those concerns into policy. Well, I think I've gone on too long already. There's a great deal in the book. It's very, very stimulating, and I think we can talk. That we can easily fill the balance of this hour with the discussion. So I'm going to hand it back over to our moderator. Thank you.
I'd like to thank all three of our panelists for a very rich menu of discussion points and themes, and I know that this room is packed with people who have their own on-the-ground experience and opinions and reactions to what's been presented. So I'm not going to, maybe I'll start off, if anyone has questions or comments and you want to line up on the left, maybe I'll start off, Jean-Marc, asking you to think about the upcoming elections in the United States and what kind of concrete recommendations you might have for the new political leadership or the old political leadership in whatever context it might occur to come forth in terms of their U.S. relation to the United Nations and U.N. reform or peacekeeping in general.
Well, 2 points. Well, 2 points. First of all, I don't think that the difference is as deep as we tend to think it is between Republicans and Democrats when it comes to foreign policy. I mean, and that's it's one of the points that I make towards the end of the book. I mean, in the U.S. at least, people tend to think that the difference is deep. I don't think, seen from the outside, the difference is not so deep. That's the first point. And the second point, I'll go back to what I tried to... In fact, it's going to be 3 points. So first point, second point, I'll go back to the list of suggestions that I had and that I alluded to in my little presentation regarding how to have U.S. foreign policy more able to contribute to a more inclusive world, but also more able to achieve security for itself as well as for international order. I found my list here. First of all, I mean, I think this idea of finding a better balance between national interest and international interest is very, very important. I mean, it has to be viewed as one of the guiding principles, I think, of what would be a more efficient, for itself as well as for international order, a more efficient U.S. foreign policy. That's the first point. Second point, I'm just repeating myself, coming to terms with the foreign policy implications of American democratic values. I mean, really, because the U.S. is not simply a global power, it's a democratic global power, we expect, because we take these democratic values very seriously, we expect a certain form of foreign policy that we wouldn't have expected, for instance, from Soviet Union. So I think that the implications of taking seriously democratic values within the U.S. as well as in terms of foreign policy haven't been really factored in as much as they should have. That's the second point. Third point, exercising leadership within multilateral constraints, and it goes back to what I was saying about this a bit self-serving understanding of the dynamics of rights and duties. I mean, if you have a global power which claims taking, which claims, and I'm not trying to be French here saying this. I mean, I'm really, I'm really, you know, partly echoing what I hear around the world. I mean, you know, if you have a global power which claims being democratic and yet has a very, very self-serving understanding and implementation of these dynamics of rights and duties, we're going to have a problem. So a more balanced understanding of what are the rights and duties for global power, which is a democratic one. And so that's part of my second point. The third point that I would make is that, in fact, I don't think that we should be very hopeful in terms of having peacekeeping operations being improved in the foreseeable future. I just wrote a piece for foreign policy, and they asked me what is going to be the future of peacekeeping operation. And in fact, I end up the piece saying that there are three reasons why we shouldn't be optimistic in terms of having peacekeeping operations being more relevant and more efficient in the future. First reason, I don't think that even though if there is a change of administration in 2008, I don't think that the commitment of the U.S. to peacekeeping operation will increase dramatically. I mean, in a way, the Bush administration represents is in a way simply a radicalization of certain characteristics which are very much at the very core of U.S. foreign policy. So, and they were at work already in the 90s during the Clinton administration. So a change of administration is not going to change drastically U.S. foreign policy towards the UN and towards peacekeeping operation. Second reason, even among member states at the UN, you don't really have a sense of seriousness. I don't think that you will find many, many member states eager to want to be serious about these things. People will... I mean, really, beyond words, you don't find much commitment to being serious about peacekeeping operations, being serious about multilateralism. I mean, if you really scratch the surface, you don't find much commitment. And thirdly, this leaves the UN Secretariat on its own, and I don't think that the Secretariat on its own can really address and redress the shortcomings that I pinpoint in the book. So in the end, you know, I don't think that things are going to change drastically in the future. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit difficult for me to come up with recommendations for change for the better.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to play the devil's advocate for a moment, if you're suggesting that most of the case studies that you look at in the book have not been successful, mm-hmm. Or have been mixed at best, why should the U.S. Congress or European member states decide that they want to put more money?
Actually, that's a very good question. I mean, you know, in a way, the UN is facing the following predicament. The UN has, as I said, minimal resources, and yet these minimal resources are not maximized, optimized, capitalized on. So then it's very, for a number of reasons, then it's very, very difficult for the UN to make the case that it needs more resources, because the very few resources that it has, it is not being, I think, used properly. So that's one point. And in fact, you know, when you talk to UN officials, when you talk, for instance, to Mr. Gaynor, who is heading the UN Department of Peacekeeping Operations, in fact, you know, these people are necessarily, you know, eager to have more tasks being given to them when it comes to peacekeeping operations, because they already feel that UN, as Ruth alluded to, has become a bit of a dumping ground. And we a few months ago, I was talking to a businessman in the context of I do fundraising in New York for my organization, and I was talking to this businessman, and he was telling me that there are two golden rules in order to be able to succeed when it comes to business. First of all, concentration of energy, and second of all, you only address the problems that you can solve. And listening to him, I was thinking about the UN. I was thinking, gee, you know, at the UN you have no concentration of energy or resources at all, and you only address the problems which you cannot solve. So where does it leave you? And lead you.
Thank you. I wonder if anyone would like to chime in.
Thank you, Brian Murphy. This has been very, very interesting. Jean-Marc, please, could you comment briefly, and you may have done this before I came in late, about the role of former Secretary General Kofi Annan during the Rwandan genocide, please?
Well, you know, he has to have, I mean, he had the role because he was the head of peacekeeping operations. There were two reports produced in the aftermath of Srebrenica and in the aftermath of Rwanda. And they are quite interesting because they had a cleansing role in a way. They were meant somehow to assign responsibility and somehow to demonstrate that there was a certain level of accountability. In the end, when you look at these reports very carefully, you don't have accountability. So I don't think that while these reports were themselves commissioned by Kofi Annan, I don't think that they do fully the job when it comes to one, assigning responsibility, and two, serving a role in terms of providing accountability.
Hi, I'm Scott Paul with Citizens for Global Solutions. Jean-Marc, thanks for your presentation. I'm wondering if any of you would care to address a problem that we're paying a fair amount of attention to that seems to be the root of a lot of underperformance in UN peacekeeping operations, which is the rapid deployment gap.
The what?
Rapid deployment gap.
Mm-hmm. I fear me the answer never changes. There are some verities in life. Most countries don't have, again, overseas logistical capability, so it really then puts them in the position of coming with a begging bowl to U.S. logisticians to do it again. And secondly, again, at least in Europe, the armies are shrinking.
Yeah.
The Germans took their draft period down from 13 months to 11 months. So by the time you teach the kid to shoot straight, he's out. And the whole point of the NATO pledge at Prague, which was supposed to induce our allies to pledge at least 2% of their GDP for military, hasn't been met. But the point was to get them some capability. The 50,000 rapid man reaction force is still on paper. I think as a lawyer, sort of an imaginary lawyer, but you should read 43, 44, 45, as at least a soft law commitment to maintain infrastructure and projection capability. No, nobody has formal Article 43 agreements that you'll have X number of troops, because people do want to pick and choose their missions, and in a democracy that's unavoidable. But architecturally, constitutionally, Article 43, 44, 45, 46, 47 is a commitment to maintain capacity to contribute. And most countries have walked away from it, and we shouldn't be at all comforted by the cash cow of peacekeeping, where many countries find it useful for hard currency. It's a way to see the world. They take half of their troops' wages. You get what you pay for. There's no training, zero of peacekeepers before they're deployed. All the discipline is still left to the sending countries. It's not a happy recipe for good policing.
If I may add 2 points, and following what Tom and Ruth said on the fact that, in fact, Europe is not really providing much support when it comes to peace operation, especially when it comes to the military dimension of peace operations. In fact, here you have, I think, you have three things taking place. First of all, you have a sense of psychological dependency that you witness in Europe vis-à-vis the US. First thing. Second thing, I think that the Europeans, to a certain extent, are taking the US for a ride. The thinking is the following: well, you want to do it, well, do it, and we'll just follow your steps. But it's really partly the thinking. But perhaps more importantly, you know, European societies have come to become very, very demilitarized cultures. I mean, you would never have in Europe, in Germany, in France, in Italy, in the UK, and so on, former generals running for president. First thing, which you have in the US, and second of all, when you look at the organigram of decision making, even including foreign policy decision making in the UK, in France, in Germany, and so on, in fact, you know, military people have been totally sidelined. They have no weight whatsoever. And I think that this third element, combined with psychological dependency and with taking the US for a ride, accounts to a large extent for the fact that we don't really deliver.
It really is. There's so many aspects, legal as well as sociological. The implications of our discussion today are really wide-ranging. I mean, there's a fair amount of literature in the U.S., not legal literature, but sociological, about the gap, even in this country, between the military and the rest of society. Mm-hmm. If you're part of the upper middle class, it's not unlikely that as a young person growing up in a nice suburb of a large city, you've not encountered anybody who served in the U.S. Armed Forces. But in Europe, that social development seems to be a half a century further ahead, in the sense that the gap between civil society at large and the armed forces is really enormous. And John Marcus now underscored that by pointing out that that gap now has a manifestation in the organogram, in the structure of decision-making in those governments. You also have a great distance between armed forces and the rest of the civilian decision-making apparatus. That's a problem. It's hard to know how to address a problem when its roots are found in the society itself. If you've got just a huge century-long social development in a certain direction, yes, you can adopt institutional solutions to try to ameliorate the negative effects of the development, but ultimately the institutions are going to be epiphenomena on top of something that's very hard to change. I guess this is not Chatham House rule, as we're on tape, and we'll soon be on the World Wide Web, so I'll take the risk of saying something completely silly and speculative, but perhaps what we should all hope for is that EADS doesn't sell too many super Airbuses to civilian airlines, so that the only market for the things is the public sector, and you'll have to buy airlift in Europe.
Looks like we had a question over here.
Hi, I'm Don Danny from Georgetown. I just had a question as to whether or not, at least, is there a silver lining? Your presentation is a bit somber, if I could put it this way. And if there's a silver lining here relative to the fact that when you think about global capacity, of course, it doesn't go just relative to troops in particular. It doesn't just go to the UN, but it goes to regional organizations and mm-hmm. also to this category called other, you know, coalitions mm-hmm. of the willing, that kind of thing. So that some of the problems that are out there in the world being inadequately addressed, but are being addressed, not necessarily through, you know, direct UN intervention. And how does that factor into your overall thinking about solidarity and how we kind of group together to try to deal with these problems that are out there in the world? Because it's not just through the UN. And is there a silver lining? Does that provide some kind of a silver lining to the cloud of thinking about these things?
Well, two answers. First of all, I mean, you are right. I mean, my tone is a bit somber. But I think the somberness of my tone equals simply the fact that, you know, I'm trying to take these values by which the UN is supposed to live seriously. And therefore, when you look at the rhetoric and the reality, there is a huge gap, which has to make you somber. So it's simply because I would want these things to be taken seriously. Second point, well, I mean, you know, in a way, I mean, in the second half of the 90s and in the early 2000s, keeping in mind or realizing the systemic shortcomings of the UN, there was an effort to somehow hand over part of the problems to regional organizations. But in fact, when you look at these regional organizations, there's only one which is more or less functional. It's NATO. I mean, it's going to be difficult, I think, to find any other regional organizations able to function within its own realm, let alone beyond its realm, beyond NATO.
Just one example, interesting function of a regional organization, which is well worth supporting. The African Union is now trying to stand up their own African Human Rights Court, and that. I really do subscribe to the view that it's the normative work of the UN that's often the most important, and embedding attractive norms in national political cultures through this conversation. But the African Court is a good example. It exists on paper now. It will, at the moment, get no cases other than through referral from the African Commission, which is a long filtration process. It has no judges who are dedicated to it. It borrows national judges. They're not international lawyers. It has a very complicated dependency on African Union politics. And yet, notionally, the idea of domesticating norms and making them part of a... Given the strength of the African group in the UN, making these norms operationally and sympathique as part of the African Union would be a very, very attractive thing.
I don't even think that they have a budget, as a matter of fact.
A tiny little budget.
Tiny little budget, yes.
Hi, I'm Will Davis from the UN Information Center, and I want to thank you all for some very thought-provoking presentations today. I was particularly struck by the two business, the golden rules of business, because focus your resources and accomplish, or focus on things that you can accomplish. And I want to try to draw that to what we're seeing now with the largest UN or UN hybrid deployment of a peacekeeping operation in history into the specific instance of Darfur. We are once again seeing a situation where it looks like we've learned very little from your case studies of the 90s. The Sudanese government is trying to exert veto right over which forces can compose the hybrid force. And in fact, we're seeing our member states much less than forthcoming in terms of providing the force enablers or the transport and attack helicopters, et cetera, to try to make an already difficult mission possible. What are your predictions in terms of the success for the hybrid force in Darfur?
I don't want to be Sambo again. I mean, it's interesting because the book finishes the book as an afterword, and the book finishes on Darfur. And when I was drafting this afterword late in the spring, actually the people from USIP were telling me, "Well, I mean, do you really want to do that? Because things could move quickly and things could happen." And I told them, "Well, don't worry, it's not going to move quickly." and yet, in the late spring of 2007, it was imminent something was going to happen. Well, here we are, November, December, and yesterday, in fact, I attended a briefing at the UN given by Eliasson, who is the chief negotiator of the current negotiations, and basically things are not moving. That's the bottom line.
Hello, Patrick Hickey with the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Let me throw out another, along the same lines with the last question, throw out the example of the U.N. forces in Lebanon. Are there things in how that mission has been substantially increased in size and in a relatively short period of time that provide some hope to you, perhaps, that the U.N. has learned some lessons in the past and that that maybe when political will is somewhat more forthcoming, they can act with quicker dispatch?
Tom goes first. That one.
Well, one of the reasons why Jean-Marc's book was so useful for me is that it had so much information of a detailed nature concerning the ins and outs of specific operations about which I knew only what I had read in the newspapers. So I'm going to defer on your questions about the, a specific operation underway in Lebanon. I don't know if I have too much to add to that. I think I'm going to defer to you. You've made me more courageous.
The great fear in the UN peacekeeping forces don't do certain things. They just don't, and one better recognize it, and then not, in full international solidarity, deride the capacity of nation states that are concerned about it, mm-hmm. or the legitimacy of those concerns. And UN peacekeeping forces don't stop weapons smuggling. So if you are worried about Hezbollah rebuilding capacity in southern Lebanon and bringing stuff in from Syria, Terry A. Reed Larson has been perfectly frank about this. I assume that Jan Eglin would be frank. They're not going to stop it. They don't see it as their mandate. They don't want to get involved in a big blowout. It leaves the Israelis in a difficult situation because you see there's a public pretense of a protective force, but it may just be a pause before the next war. So I just think that my third business rule would be truth in advertising, mm-hmm. that you ought not. If one is, I'm really very much concerned about the polarization of politics in mm-hmm. this country and internationally. Mm-hmm. And if there are limitations on what UN or other multilateral organizations can and will do, mm-hmm. that they ought not then to make it a hobby to deride efforts of others to counter those mm-hmm. kinds of very serious strategic threats. And the M word, you're not acting multilaterally, is such an old whipping boy now that whatever one says entre nous, en famille, en tape about this, that problem, still the larger message is if you're not doing it multilaterally, it's devilish. And that's not a good message mm-hmm. for responsible democracies that need some sense of moral pride to stay engaged.
I think it goes back to what is a key issue, the need to find ways to dovetail power and legitimacy. If you have power without legitimacy, power is being undermined. If you have legitimacy without power, it's useless. And I think we have to think about finding ways to really re-dovetail which these things which at one point were working together, and somehow the fact that we're living in a very, very polarized world inside the UN as well as outside the UN is very much the illustration of this disconnect and growing disconnect existing between power and legitimacy. How do we reconnect the two now? I think that's one of the challenges, and that's not easy to do.
And it goes back to the problem of obtaining maximum participation in any given project, whether it be a treaty or mm-hmm. intervention or a peacekeeping operation, and the problem is that to obtain maximum participation, you either have to obscure the purposes of the mandate by rendering them highly ambiguous, or just expressly drop certain elements out. Mm-hmm. For example, we shall not interdict arms coming into Lebanon. If that's the price of obtaining consent, then you do at some point, as I think Ruth was alluding to, have to ask whether it's worth seeking the consent for the operation on that basis, or whether perhaps a less widely inclusive approach is necessary to actually get the task performed. You can only perform the task that the participants want to perform. Membership in the operation can determine the task.
Mm-hmm. No, and just to go back to follow on what Ruth was saying, I mean, you're absolutely right. The level of polarization within the UN has only grown the past 6 or 7 years, and I mean, the gap is a source of great concern for people who want to try to have things working out.
Hi, Jean-Marc. How are you? This may be a very quixotic question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. As I'm sure you know, there are some efforts in terms of lobbying those with power in the UN system to try to establish a standing force. Mm-hmm. This has been a project of the World Order Project and a number of people in the international law community and elsewhere. Is that totally a chimera? Is there any hope of that ever happening, given the scenarios that you've sketched out and the lack of will? There are arguments that could be made that this really might make a difference in critical situations, and There are also some interesting initiatives, such as a nonviolent peace force that has some standing with some folks in the UN system, where people are trained to go out in situations about to explode and try to deal with the conflicting parties in terms of some peace-building work. So anyway, what's possible and what's a dream?
Could you identify yourself, please?
Yes, I'm Mindy Reiser, and I'm active in many things, but the UN Association here in Washington is one of them.
I don't think that it is possible, but I don't think that it is a possibility. I mean, member states would be, first and foremost, the permanent members of the Security Council would be, I think, very much against it, I think. Because they want to keep the monopoly of use of force.
If I could add on, this certainly was an idea that was floating around about 1994, 1995.
Still floating.
And at first blush, it seemed attractive. Why not have this rapid reaction force? And the idea was added that it could be volunteers so their countries wouldn't be implicated. Once I got to know some military folks after my middle class upbringing in a suburb of a northeastern city, I was quickly dissuaded from it for a couple reasons. One is that just if you take UN ratios, U.S. ratios, 3-1, you know, rotating in and out of the field, and 7-1, tooth to tail, or make it the European style, 4-1, to put 5,000 people in the field would require a huge force. And as one sees in peacekeeping missions like Congo, it's a drop in a bucket to put even 5,000 people out there. Secondly, just that it underestimates the need for training together, ethos, the culture of a military force. You can't just have ragtag, go as arc of one of each and hope to operate safely for force protection, for protection of civilians. I would be delighted if France, Germany, and Britain would each pledge, and Poland, make it, Czechia, whatever, pledge 5,000 persons each to be available on 72 hours notice and have under Article 43, this fervent pledge of availability. But run by the UN, I don't think it could ever work as such.
And in fact, just to add to what Ruf is saying, developed countries are less and less willing to contribute to peacekeeping operations in terms of troops. I mean, it's a trend, it's another trend.
Other questions, comments? I'll toss out one quick one. I was just thinking about the news that in Liberia there was a mission of all women peacekeepers, and I'm wondering, is that something that has become more common, becoming more common? Has it been judged to be successful? Might it be a new direction for some of the peacekeepers? Are there many women peacekeepers currently?
I will not answer directly the question, but I will answer it in a related fashion. One of the most interesting stories when it comes to human resources in the UN context since the early 90s has to do with women. In fact, more and more women apply to the UN. And it has to do with, I wrote a piece on the matter, that's why, it has to do with trends of skilled people, trends of global immigration of skilled people. Most of the people who are skilled and migrating globally, not most of them, but a huge amount of them are women. And they happen to see very often when it comes to business possibilities, the UN as a good possibility. I don't know if it applies to peacekeeping operations, but I certainly know that when it comes to the number of people applying to the UN, women, especially coming from developing countries, are an interesting phenomenon.
Well, I think part of it also has to do with the question of legitimacy. If you have peacekeepers who have been violating women in wartime situations and women who are feeling very vulnerable, having women come in may be a way to increase the legitimacy of UN peacekeeping operations.
But you're saying that there are units which are specifically made of... I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. If I could just mention, in Bosnia, there were some Danish, at least one or more, I believe they were famous anyway, Danish female tank commanders who were apparently quite kick-ass. They were not to be fooled with. And the UN has been very slow, I hate to say it as a female, to get on board with this idea that you have to have a women's component in transitional administration offices. Certainly the issue of sexual abuse by peacekeepers. Jane Hall Lute took this very seriously and went down to Congo to inquire into it. Back when Manfred Eisel was the peacekeeping military planner in PKO, there was concern about spread of HIV/AIDS by peacekeepers, and they perchance had had some medical jackets on one force, which they sent home, but chose not to collect on other contingents that were being provided, because it was sort of embarrassing. So I do think that a sense of the damage that an untrained force can do, even wearing blue berets, which affects women as much as or more than anybody else, is something that the UN has to have very much in mind and has to cure its own political culture, where I still tell my students it's not a good place for a woman to work, even in the secretariat, especially in the secretariat.
Mm-hmm. And to take up the phrase, even wearing blue berets, to put on the international lawyer's beret, I would say especially if wearing blue berets, because if the problem that we're trying to address is the risk that a peacekeeping force transgresses a rule, and the peacekeeping force is a UN force and not the force of a member state, the problem of responsibility, which was one of the problems we were talking about at the beginning of our session today, comes up in full force. It comes up in full force because the mechanisms for accountability and responsibility, as underdeveloped as they might be toward states under international law, are radically less developed with respect to international organizations. A member state operating, at least we have a rudimentary system for attributing responsibility to the state for things it does wrong. If the state puts its forces under the UN umbrella or beret or whatever you want to refer to it as, you have the risk of a type of legal shielding from responsibility, and that's very problematic.
I should note there, by the way, very interesting conversations going on now in the International Law Commission on principles of the responsibility of international organizations.
Right.
And with Michael Nunes here, and knows much more about this than I do, but the whole issue of the responsibility of a commander to anticipate and prevent harm done by troops is one that does not exempt the UN.
No, and I would argue that at the global level, accountability within the UN context is close to zero. I mean, yeah.
One more question.
Hi, my name is Sophia Tesomariam, and I'm with the U.S. Foundation for the Horn of Africa. Special interest to me today is ANMI, the United Nations mission in Eritrea and Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And today, actually, the virtual demarcation of the Eritrean-Ethiopian border with the Eritrean-Ethiopian Border Commission finishing its work, technical work, which was supposed to be done with pillars on the ground, has not been able to be done because Ethiopia has refused to accept the decision and the United States has refused to enforce the EEBC decision. So, with special interest to resources of the United Nations being not there, and then at the same time the political will not being there at the Security Council to enforce an international decision with the Eritrea-Ethiopia Boundary Commission decision. How do you, what do you see going forward with ANMI, which was supposed to be there until the pillars were put on the ground? And now we're not going to have pillars on the ground unless the EEBC decides to extend its mandate or extend its... after waiting for 5 years, I can understand why I didn't want to continue going with the status quo. So what do we have to see to look forward to, and what is the future of ANMI the way you see it, between international law not being enforced by the Security Council and the depletion of resources? I think it's $250 million. To keep ANMI, to separate the two forces on an already demarcated border now, as of today.
Personally, I'm not very familiar with the operation, so I'm not in a position to answer.
I was not so long ago acting as assistant to one of the agent, one of the council. I don't think I can really comment on it because of a professional relationship to the problem. What to say? I'll defer to Ruth.
I don't know a whole lot about it either, other than to say that what is happening in the Eritrean and the Ethiopian is at least one very interesting sort of experimental exercise in trying to estimate the amount of harm caused to each side in its,
right.
in its civilian infrastructure. I mean, internalizing the cost of war in a way that has probably quite radical implications. But other than the fact that this, I used to call it the war of the rate of exchange, as opposed to Bosnia, which is the war of the vowels. The source of Ethiopian-Eritrean enmity is still, to be frank, utterly mysterious to me.
I guess I could add, in connection with the book, that there are serious issues in the Eritrean-Ethiopian dispute as to the relation between Jus ad Bellum and Jus in Bello. This is an area of interest to Jean-Marc, and it comes out in interesting ways in the book. And the question with respect to damages is whether a prior finding of responsibility for starting the war causes an all-encompassing effect on damages, or can one of the combatants escape responsibility for certain damages by reference to the conduct of the war? In other words, you have two questions: the law governing whether you can go to war, and then the law governing how you carry out war. If you are culpable because you didn't follow the prior set of rules and you started the war without justification, does that mean that there really is no damages question at all? You as the state who started the war, you inherit all of the damages. Or can you say, well, yes, perhaps we were responsible for starting it, but at least in the conduct of the war, some of the damages that occurred cannot be attributed to us because we acted within the rules. That's been a major question, as you probably know, in the Eritrea Ethiopia situation, and it shows that there really is practical significance to this old, it's almost an Augustinian question about the rules governing going to war and the rules governing how you carry out war, but those are not just medieval preoccupations.
Veterans, however, of the Versailles Treaty and the Dawes Plan and
right.
German reparations would tread very cautiously here.
Indeed.
Before you start the next war.
Right, yeah. Right, yes.
Well, unless there are any other burning questions, I think we'll bring today's panel to a close. I'd like to thank Jean-Marc Bacot and Ruth Wedgwood and Tom Grant, and I'd like to thank all of you for your participation and in the discussion. Take care.